I want you just to mention, to remember that, 3,000 miles of free trade, because I want to come back to it in a minute when I try to put before you a practical proposition. If you take the United States, United Kingdom and Canada, together, those three do 40% of the world's trade. If you add Western Europe and South America, it's 90%. Russia, with her satellites and China, does less than 8% of the world's trade. That shows something of the disequilibrium in the modern world. The question of how economically exploitable world supplies of coal, oil, metals, timber, and other non-reproductive or very slowly reproducing raw materials can keep pace with this great hunger of men and industry may well involve, before long, a very considerable degree of world economic planning quite apart from preparations for war. In my country at the present time, and I was reading this morning from press reports, we are in the worst thing that's hit us at the present moment isn't even the shortage of meat, it's the shortage of sulfur. Which almost entirely comes from the United States, which is vital for so many industries. And the shortage, of course, of half a dozen other raw materials. The raw materials of the world are, well, take my own country today, although we've got a higher man output per week, although men are now working on Saturdays, which they used previously to do in the coal pits, and although the output for the country is greater this last month than it's been for many years, we are actually having to bring coals to Newcastle to illustrate it by an old saying. Well, here are a few facts about the modern world which particularly affect Asia and Africa. What is clear is that a large-scale transference of know-how and resources must be made with all the administrative skill that is possible. And the administrative skill lies very largely in the English-speaking world. This great, vast conception of a Marshall Plan. Shape. Huge organizations in your country and some that we've got within the Dominion. There are very few other countries, one or two in Europe, Western Europe, who are capable of that administrative skill. We've got, firstly, as far as these countries are concerned, to respect nationalism. War nearly always breeds nationalism. You remember Woodrow Wilson, Czechoslovakia, and all that. Well, this time the nationalisms come in the East. And it has to be respected. And secondly, we must see that this nationalism is not directed against the white man as such. The best antidote that I can give is the personal example and the character of the technicians, the administrators, and the professional men. Never was there such a need for engineers, technologists, scientists, educators, doctors, agriculturalists, veterinary surgeons, nurses, as there is at the moment, over a whole new stretch of the world. And we have had to set up special organizations in Britain to deal with this because we are a bit short of them, in some cases at home. We are very happy to be able to sit down as equals with our colleagues from India, Pakistan, and Ceylon, and to work out the Colombo Plan, not the British Plan, not the London Plan, not the Sydney Plan, Colombo Plan. It's got to be made as if the whole thing comes from them. And that's why called it the Colombo Plan. As if it was from Ceylon itself. Because any trace of imperialism, which doesn't exist any longer anyway in my country, must be torn away from these ideas. There are schemes for federation in East Africa and the Caribbean. There are new constitutions, some of them of a very progressive order, being canvassed in the African territories, like the Gold Coast. And but for the Chinese Communist bandits, bandits, there would now be a new era of prosperity and security in Malaya, with a very considerable measure of home rule and a brand new university which has just been set up. While new university colleges have been established in Africa, East and West, in the West Indies, in the Sudan, and elsewhere. A new attack is being made on illiteracy, sickness, and low levels of agricultural production. In most colonies, labor experts are helping to organize bona fide trade unions. No doubt all these attempts fall short of what is necessary, but they show evidence of goodwill and efficiency. And one of the things that has to be combated today is that the communists say they are the people who get things done. These are evidences of getting things done, just as the vast technological skill of America is one of the things most envied in the Soviet Union. The specialized agencies of the United Nations, like UNESCO and ILO and WHO, the lead given by the President of the United States, are all evidence of a movement among the free nations to share their knowledge and their resources with the less developed countries. I only wish we could dramatize this whole effort and tell the Asiatic and the African world that we mean to continue to act as friends. But if I may take the Commonwealth just for one moment, it's not any longer, I believe, called the British Commonwealth, called the Commonwealth. You hardly call it British with Indians and Pakistan. It's become more international. Though the British tradition has its roots in legal and parliamentary and the education system, but the social composition has changed. It now includes vast illiterate masses who are only dimly aware of political and international responsibilities. We're no longer just countries with similar experience like New Zealand, Australia, Canada. New issues, new attitudes. Indeed, quite divergent policies, as over Korea. In the military side, it's very difficult to see what Far East strategy is going to work out. We are no longer concerned primarily with status. The old Commonwealth was quite very important. Is Canada at war when Britain is at war? What is the status of Canada? Like all new countries, they were very concerned with status, just as new schools, new types of things always are concerned with status. But that's all rather finished now. Questions of defense, economics, mutual aid are the important thing. And there is a shift from the centralized imperial pattern to a more equal sharing of responsibilities. And in each case, a greater dependence on the United States of America. Find that in Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. The Commonwealth is, via Canada, a North Atlantic community. And via India and Pakistan, an Indian Ocean group. And therefore, it has significance in the Southwest Pacific. The weaknesses, militarily, are obvious. We haven't got enough naval units for the whole area. We're menaced in Malaya, where there are 35,000 troops with young men on young drafts at the present moment, and in the Middle East, which is very important from the point of view of oil. Kashmir locks up enormous armies, both in Pakistan and in India. In the economic field, we have the problem of adjusting the sterling and the dollar area. I hope there will be less and less talk about Britain or sterling area defeating the dollar or the dollar defeating the sterling area. Believe me, in these times of crisis, that talk means nothing to me. If we happen to be doing 51% of the trade of the world in the sterling area, well, I'm not particularly interested, or vice versa. What really interests me is whether some modus vivendi can be made for the two areas living together. It's a very curious area anyway. Canada is not in it, but Burma is, and Iraq, and Ireland, and Iceland. The Commonwealth finance ministers have met in 1949. They decided together on a 25% reduction in dollar purchases. And at Colombo again, they decided to continue that 25%. I don't know whether it was right. It was a very conservative estimate. But of course, we've all got to conserve our cash if we're going to be free from what is called martial aid. Got to preserve our dollars, naturally. India devalued, Pakistan didn't. So it's a very curious collection of people. As I was saying this afternoon, it was wittily described by somebody the other day who was asked whether the Commonwealth countries met at Lake Success. And somebody said, there are no meetings. But at any meetings that take place, no agreements are made. And any agreements that are made are not binding. That, I think, in a rather sort of Irish way, describes very much the way it works. We have another problem, which is called the sterling balances, sometimes called unrequited exports. They were once 14 billion, they are now 9. And these, I'm afraid, were built up by India, Pakistan, and Egypt, as well as Australia, during the war. It's a very heavy drain on our resources. And if I may say so, it sometimes makes us very angry. We have to pay Egypt millions and millions every year, first of all from saving their skins, because they did precious little in the war. And however, it has to be paid. And there it is. The Colombo plan, which is for 8 millions to help Southeast Asia, has to be somehow worked out in conjunction with these sterling balances. There are still certain disputes within the Commonwealth, Pakistan, India, the Indian problem in South Africa. But jointly and generally speaking, it is the United States and the Commonwealth and my country that bear the bulk of the burden in the United Nations and the specialized agencies. If you just look at the total contributions to UNESCO or anywhere else, it's about 70%. And if you look at the people who have to do the jobs, administrative and otherwise, they're very largely USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and UK. That doesn't mean that the Indians aren't playing an important part, the French here and there, and Norwegian and Scandinavian. But I'm taking it in bulk. If you cut that out, you cut out the basis of the whole of these organizations. Part of the Commonwealth is a bit more private enterprise. I should say Canada and particularly New Zealand at the present moment, whereas Australia and UK perhaps are more planning. There are important differences over Japan, but on the whole of the Commonwealth can be called anti-communist, although there were some differences here again. We and Pakistan and India recognized China, and India really opposed the recognition of the leader in Indochina. But in general, which is a very sound thing. I know my Ceylon friends, and they've been very much tempted the other way. On the whole, India, Pakistan, Ceylon, certainly Australia and New Zealand and Canada, and the rest, are anti-communist. And generally, they've got friendly relations with the rest of the world. Now, I mention the new Commonwealth, because remember, it's something brand new. It's unlike the British Commonwealth of 10 years ago, quite unlike it, as that was unlike the one which preceded the Statute of Westminster. That's before they were independent countries. Now let me return to the Atlantic Community. If there is misunderstanding between the Commonwealth and the USA, there's less excuse for misunderstanding between Britain and Europe. And yet, as I said in my opening remarks, never, in my experience, in the last 30 years, has there been so much. Why is this? One has to go back into history a little bit. There is an economic disequilibrium growing up for 30 years, and which the war only accentuated and brought to a head. Some people seem to think that the Marshall Plan and all the rest of it is something that just was due to the war. but it seems to escape people who will not read their history that it wasn't an accident that millions of dollars of gold found its way to Fort Knox between the two wars. That was a symbol of a disequilibrium between Europe and the United States. It was not an accident that Germany and Italy produced those economic nationalist regimes which we call fascism and Nazism. It was an attempt to live on their own, to build up a sort of self-sufficing economy, which won't work. It's finished. It was not an accident that Britain embarked on bilateral economic treaties in the 30s, what was called the Ottawa Agreement,